Determining soft power amidst a pandemic, shifting attitudes towards race in Brazil, and how bricks and mortar retail is responding to an irregular Christmas season. Monocle's editors tackle those topics today on the late edition here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the late edition. I'm Augustin Macellari, joined today here in London by Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck and Monocle 24's producer and culture correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome both. Welcome back, Fernando. You've been on holiday. A little bit later on, we're going to talk about bricks and mortar retail spaces. I just thought before we did that, we're kind of approaching the end of the UK's second national lockdown. There's a lot of uncertainty around what's going to happen, but I wondered which shops you two are both looking forward to patronising once more, Andrew? Is there somewhere you can't wait to get back to?
I don't know. It's funny because everything is so different every time you go into one of these things. So I have some friends who run a very nice kind of garden centre come shop. And I went down there on Saturday to see their new outpost. They're allowed to open this time. The first time round, you couldn't at the beginning of lockdown. It was not seen as an essential shop. Now, plants are seen as essential, so it was open. And because there's not much happening, it was so busy. There were like so many people wanting to buy plants and things. So I don't feel deprived of retail in that sense this time. You know, and food stores are open and opticians are open. So actually, when you get out of the centre, if you go to the neighbourhoods, it still feels like people have found some way to keep going. The only thing is that notion of browsing, which you just cannot do. So I wouldn't mind perhaps buying some clothes, but I keep putting it off because I can't be bothered to order stuff online. And then even when you could go in shops recently, it's been such a kind of faff to kind of like try anything on. So I think when we ease back into being able to kind of retail become a kind of a distraction, a moment of pleasure, the idea of finding something that you weren't particularly looking for, that's the bit I'm looking for, and I'm not sure that's going to come rushing back before Christmas.
True, and it's definitely complicated. Just after the first lockdown ended, I got a very dirty look from a man in a clothes shop when I tried on a sweatshirt, and he smartly informed me that now it had to be quarantined for 72 hours, thank you very much, which did take a bit of the joy out of it. Faye, what about you?
Well, I had a bad experience buying a perfume online because I was just buying through the ingredients, and then it wasn't for me. I mean, I actually had a headache after. Thankfully, my partner, I said, he loved it, but I said, just don't wear it close to me. So I do
that's a bit complicated.
That's true. So I just want to go to a shop and browse around through several perfumes. I like to change my scents time to time.
I think this is it. And we shall hear more about browsing a little bit later on in the programme today. But first, Monocle's annual Soft Power Survey is out this Thursday in the December-January issue of Monocle magazine. Given that it's been a highly challenging year, it's perhaps understandable that some of the metrics have shifted, from measuring the cultural impact of cinematic releases, so many of course have been delayed, to the challenges of Zoom diplomacy. Andrew, given these kind of obstacles, these challenges that we've spoken a lot about and been living with, you know, for much of this year, what does soft power look like in the time of COVID?
Well, it's true. Many of the things that you would normally rely on to be your assets, your cultural assets, the way that your diplomats work, have just been shuttered. When you look at the US, for example, one of the ways that the US has always been effective at winning people over is by the people who've gone there to study in its elite universities, for example. So it's made these connections with would-be leaders around the world. Well, they suspended most of those student visas, so people just haven't gone to study in the US. When you think about the US and what it does with cultural exports, so many films have been pulled this year that the Hollywood box office has, of course, been important, but nothing like in recent years. Maybe Netflix has stepped into its place in a way to keep us entertained. But all of these things are down. You know, diplomats, you know, aren't doing diplomatic parties. You know, that all these things we think of as being the way that we get our soft power across have stuttered. And the other thing is people's response to COVID, and it's a roller coaster because some countries they seem to be doing very well and then they're not, and vice versa. But I think globally, it's hit China. It's certainly hit a country like the US, and you know, Fernando's Brazil. Maybe at home, people have been more accepting of the way people have got through this terrible pandemic. But globally, it hasn't been good for Brazil's reputation, and it certainly hasn't been good for the UK's or that of the US. Some countries have done well parlaying in a way, like New Zealand, but even there, it's like when you're so closed off to the rest of the world, what does it mean for New Zealand in the long term when nobody's going there? It's like a closed kingdom, so that you begin to lose your soft power potential.
Fernando, it's no secret over the past sort of 4 years, arguably more, liberal values have kind of crept further into mainstream politics, and I think many of our listeners might be happy with. At times like this, do you think that soft power becomes more crucial as an avenue for upholding a kind of global liberal set of values?
Oh, absolutely. And well, let's look at one country in particular, which I think did very well with the soft power survey that we did here at Monaco, Germany. I mean, you have Angela Merkel as a leader. I mean, she's extremely competent. And, you know, some people say that she's the last bastion of, you know, of liberalism in a way. But, you know, again, Germany, they handled COVID-19 quite well. I'm sure there was another wave, perhaps they didn't handle as well as the first. But, you know, but she is a competent leader. I think she will be missed in the world stage next year. And that's and that's a huge asset for a country to have a good leader. I mean, as Andrew was saying, you know, those countries that didn't handle the pandemic very well, I mean, okay, some people in those countries, you know, they appreciate the leader being Trump or Bolsonaro. But again, they are very divisive. You know, they are speaking to half of the country, I would say. They are not like perhaps like someone like Angela Merkel. I think that's essential more than ever, especially this year because of the pandemic.
And that comes to an issue of trust, doesn't it, Andrew? Because there is this kind of correlation between the amount of faith a public has in its government and its sort of response to the coronavirus outbreak.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, a lot of the role of soft power that we look at is what it says about you outside your country, how it appeals. But yeah, it begins at home. If your people have lost faith in the way that you are navigating this pandemic, then it doesn't do you very much good when you then try and tell your story externally either. So I think the UK has, you know, had a tough time both explaining to its public how to behave during this time and give it consistent ideas to follow. But I think it's also, you know, it's been a choppy period with Brexit. There's just too much going on for people to focus on the softer elements of what makes Britain great. You know, so the idea of no tourism, for example, we have millions of people who come here every year. And without them, that's, again, like lots of people who just go home with, you know, memories of this place, of ideas of places they'd like to go back to, who tell stories about the nice time they hopefully had. So Britain's been a little bit, again, kind of like on the sidelines in the soft power world. So we'll see what happens in the coming years. But this year it's been a bit of an interesting mix because lots of smaller countries have jumped up. It's been a real kind of shakedown of the list.
One of the things that I was really struck by going through the survey was this way that kind of long-standing avatars for a country's soft power have started to shift. There's a very interesting short piece about TikTok when it talks about Coca-Cola and McDonald's, these American companies that definitely played a part in the kind of triumph of the West at the end of the Cold War. And it's curious how anachronistic these big brands now look. They present, you know, they're representative of a certain type of lifestyle. They're a product that people want access to. But now we have these things like TikTok, which is China is billing as its own serious soft power asset, hundreds of millions of users worldwide. But it's not just a product, is it? It's not just a digital service. There's also this suggestion that maybe it's a data harvesting tool, or maybe it's being used to train artificial intelligences. And it's just amazing how this whole system is becoming a bit more complicated.
And even though I wanted that story in the magazine, we should point out that I presume that there's quite a lot of young Americans who don't even realise who owns it. So,
right.
its potential for soft power for China is limited by your knowledge of who owns it. But undoubtedly, all of these technology companies have a big impact around the world. Whether you're an Apple, for example, Apple does for America interesting things, and the same for TikTok. It shows China as being maybe a little bit more fun than people imagined, maybe a little bit more new and inventive than people imagined. So it does do it some good, unless you have someone like Donald Trump who's determined to close you down. So that's the difficulty.
Quite. Well, for more on our soft power survey, do make sure to pick up your copy of the December-January issue of Monocle. It'll be on newsstands from Thursday. Here on Monocle 24, we've got lots on the subject as well. You can tune into a very special conversation between our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and Simonetta Sommaruga, who is the president of Switzerland. That's premiering tomorrow at 1300 London time. And as if that weren't enough, do tune into the Foreign Desk this Saturday at midday London time for a soft power special. Let's move along now to Brazil. The brutal on-camera killing of a black man, João Alberto Silveira Freitas, by security guards has sparked protests. While the demonstrations echo the Black Lives Matter movement, which was triggered in the US last summer by the murder of George Floyd, they speak to a broader shift in attitudes towards race that's underway in Brazil. Fernando, maybe you could tell us, just to kind of contextualize it, a little bit about the difference between American and Brazilian perceptions of race and racism.
No, it's interesting to discuss this because, you know, the media is portraying this as the George Floyd moment in Brazil, which, you know, perhaps in the terms of how the media is paying attention to the topic, which I think is great, because finally, because race and racism, that's the difference with the United States. It's been a taboo for years. The reason is, if you're a black kid in the US, you know that the country has some kind of racial structures, and, you know, they had segregation laws in the country. I mean, in Brazil, we never had that. We grew up believing it was a racial democracy, that there's no space for prejudice here. I mean, you could see, if you go to a favela, you know, the majority of the residents who will be black, you know, they have, you know, the worst jobs when it comes to salaries. There hasn't been any kind of, you know, we didn't have a black president yet. The United States had one before Brazil, and we had more black people as percentage of our population. So, you know, this Brazil is very much a racist country. But if you're a black child in Brazil, you don't know why you're going to protest. You grow up knowing that there's nothing to protest about. I mean, if you are poor, you're just poor, not because of your color of your skin. But things are changing, you know. I mean, we still see, as you know, the case of this brutal murder at Carrefour in Porto Alegre. But things are changing. I mean, every time I go back to Brazil, I think people know more a little bit about their rights. And yes, perhaps they have been influenced about, you know, the black movements in the United States as well. It's an ongoing story, I would say.
Andrew, we're obviously just talking about soft power and the impact that kind of autocratic or these populist so-called strongman leaders can have on that. And I wonder, you know, if what we see in Brazil, certainly what happened in America and is ongoing in America, if the counterpoint to these figures who sort of legitimize hatred in what has come to be called their base, if at the same time they inspire a strong pushback from people who might otherwise keep quiet, who might otherwise sort of not stand up against these structures that they recognize as being problematic, but which don't necessarily affect them.
We have a Brazilian in the room, so I don't want to say too much because I he's more the expert than me. But what strikes me is that the Brazilian dream, as it were, as Fernando is hinting, is so powerful and so intoxicating. It's this a real world of, you know, extraordinary culture, of music, of lifestyles, of nature, of scenery. I think it's so powerful that it also blinds people who are local as well as people who are external. So, you know, maybe as you're an outsider, you go there and the first times you're a little bit shocked by the proximity of this staggering wealth and staggering poverty, of the juxtapositions that you see out your car window or as you walk the street every time. And I think that actually that's for many Brazilians as well. They like to persuade themselves that actually things are pretty good. And the cliche is, when you're in Rio, people will say to you again and again, oh, you know, you go to the beach and, you know, how can wealth matter in this country when you go to the beach and everybody's in exactly the same swimming trunks and everyone's wearing Havaianas? It's obvious we're just the same. We're just the same people. We're all Brazilians. But of course, at the end of the day, when people come off the beach, you see the people who are going back to the favelas with their ice boxes, getting a bus that may take them 2.5 hours to get them home. And you see the wealthy walking a block back to their home in Leblon. Then you see that there is naivety in that belief that everybody is the same once they're on the beach. But it's just a very powerful image that Brazilians, you know, cling to. And And I think that's difficult for all of us, wherever we are. We like to think that we live in reasonably inclusive societies, and it's only when we bang up against it. I don't want to spoil too much, because Fernanda's written something for tomorrow for the Monocle Minute, which I would urge everyone to read. And, you know, Fernanda, you're adopted, and you said that actually this has made you reflect on your race, on your colour, on how you feel yourself about being Brazilian.
No, very much so. And you were saying, I mean, this myth is so powerful that even local Brazilians, even if you're black Brazilian, you would believe in that. And definitely you see that in Rio, this thing, oh, the beaches where everyone mixes. I mean, partially it is true, but as Andrew says, you might go back to your, you know, lovely apartment in Leblon, or you go back to the favela. But, you know, just keeping into positive terms, I mean, just looking at race, in the US is very easy to define if you're black, you're Latino, you're white. In Brazil, it is a bit complicated, because you wouldn't, you know, Brazil is a very mixed country. You have so many different types of skin colors in a way. But usually people, they try not to say they're black because there's a stigma to it. So they try to cling to any sign of European heritage that they might have. So it's interesting what is changing, even in our more recent election. I mean, it's impressive. 42,000 candidates for councillors and mayors, they changed their skin color compared to the previous election. So most people, they moved from white to brown, which we call pardo. There's been a lot of moves from brown to black as well. So people are changing the way they define themselves. And that's in a way because the movement, you know, against racism is becoming stronger. And it's quite interesting. Sometimes, you know, it's interesting, even, you know, when Andrew was saying I was adopted, it's written there in my birth certificate that I'm white. But then I was talking to my mom, I'm actually not white. what's the deal? And she said, Fernando, we just had to put there because it was easier. Apparently the person was writing, they wanted to put the same color as your birth parents. But do you know what I mean? How flexible it is in a way. So definitely I would define myself as mixed race or black or whatever it is. But there's been kind of this moving away from just being white or clinging to the European heritage.
We should point out as an aside, anyone who's met Fernando's mum, the most extraordinary, wonderful woman, and amazing that you have these open conversations with her.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
But I guess also, you know, for you all, because, you know, luckily for Monocle, you've been to various places, and I've been like to Mexico, for example, where, again, you have the same thing that people, like, the people who can trace their heritage back to the Spaniards, they're like, we're not Mexican Mexicans, we're like the Spanish Mexicans. Or when you go to India and you're in the north of India, where people, you know, they look more Iranian, many of them. They're very light-skinned. And there you hear people being racist about other Indians, saying, oh, you know, very dark-skinned people in the south of India, you know, they're not the same as us. It's not as cultured as here in the north. You know, people, even with their own cultures, there's this terrible thing that people like to divide themselves off and find what's special about themselves and put them in themselves in different categories. And that's unfortunately perhaps not done on a day-to-day basis in Brazil, but is just as pertinent. Right. It is there, even though people don't like to acknowledge it.
And finally then, just before we move on from this, what's that going to be like, do you think, for individuals living in Brazil who this, you know, affects, who are starting to have to kind of maybe think differently about their self-image, about how their national identity has made them think about themselves?
Well, I think, as I said, things are changing. Hopefully this case can become emblematic. And I have to say, I don't want to sound here, you know, too glib or too positive, but every time I go back to Brazil now, I feel, you know, I see more people like me on TV watching a soap opera, which I used to love. When I was living there, it was honestly just white people on soap operas. There was here a random character. Things are changing very fast in that sense. Things are very bad. There's still racism, as you can see with this case. But, you know, there's been some slow progress.
Well, let's move along now. Finally, a slight change of pace for this story. The most wonderful time of the year is fast approaching. Depending on your perspective, Christmas shopping is a lovely opportunity to find an object that reflects your affection for your nearest and dearest, or it's an experience so stressful that the holiday period becomes absolutely necessary time to recover your shattered nerves. Wherever on the spectrum you fall, there's no question that it's going to be altogether different this year. Earlier, Dana Thomas, who's the Paris-based author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes, outlined some of the methods bricks and mortar spaces are bringing to the World Wide Web to try and recreate the pleasure of browsing.
They're trying to figure out new ways to do it, to sell to us. And some brands have come up with some cool ideas. Ralph Lauren has started a virtual store where you can go and visit their stores online, but you're walking through the Paris store, you're walking through the New York store, you're seeing the displays, and then you go like, wow, that shoe's really cool, and you can look at it in a 360-degree view. Much better than just like scrolling through one-dimensional photograph flat pictures on a web page, hundreds of them at a time. And they're also working with social media like Instagram. Shopping has become bigger and bigger. Snapchat is launching sales and having a shopping interaction. And that's a much more fun way to shop than, again, just looking at a website like Net-a-Porter or Farfetch and just scrolling through pages and pages of black dresses. They're really trying to make it fun and sexy.
Dana Thomas there. Fernando, what do you think? Do you like the sound of digital Ralph Lauren?
Can I be really honest with you?
You must.
No. and the reason why, I mean, Ralph Lauren is a brand that I shop. I actually quite like Ralph Lauren. And funnily enough, I was there a week before this new lockdown here in the UK. And, you know, I was trying a half-zip sweater that I love from then. And I discovered I'm not an M anymore. I'm a large. And you know, which is awful news. But at the same time, it's true. I had a lovely chat with the salesman. And I don't think the same experience could be done online. Of course, I'm not going to lie. I do buy online as well. But, yeah, it doesn't excite me. But I'm glad they are doing something different than just showing the product. I mean, whatever they can to improve the shopping experience, the better. But I would recommend to go to the shop and perhaps you put up a size on that.
Fernando, I think it was very rude of them not to communicate that they were making their patterns smaller.
Exactly.
Andrew, you know, listening to Dana there, that joyless scrolling that she describes kind of on Net-a-Porter going through pages and pages of black dresses, it's never really been fun. It's never really been a nice part of the digital retail experience. Is it a bit odd that actually it's taken so long for people, it's taken a whole pandemic to get people to actually invest in turning, you know, these digital spaces into something that's a little bit more engaging?
Well, there's two interesting things. One, I think you just heard from Dana there, she spoke, you know, all the words that she's using, they're aimed at a very particular demographic. How many 6-year-olds are on Snapchat? They're not there. So this is marketing to a young, tech-savvy audience. And for them, maybe these things will click through and work. And I think you're right. On the other side, is like you have this experience where you either go to a website and it's got like three things and they're not what you want, or you go to a website and you can't. You type in, you know, your search category and it brings up like 6,000, or you look at the bottom, it says 240 pages. You're like, where do you begin? And then you just feel exhausted. So you kind of give in on the whole process. I think there are definitely things that work, you know, you're buying online, especially when you're repeating an order or you know something you like. But I just don't even trust myself when it's that category. I was trying to replace a pair of shoes the other day. And they had a sizing thing, and it made me, I looked at the size I've got, and then I looked at the sizing that they said it should be. They said, be wary, you should be like half size smaller than you normally are. So suddenly, I looked at my pair, it was like two sizes smaller than I was. So then I thought, oh God, I can't do this until they're open again. So I just think that, you know, there's a lot of people who, unless you're buying something that's, you know, that's a really kind of throwaway product, or that you just know is a repeat order, even now, there's lots of people who will want to return to bricks and mortar stores if they're exciting and they're done well. And I, you know, I actually remain quite hopeful that in the new year, retail will bounce back.
Well, quite. I think that's a good place to leave it. But for one question, given that the festive season,
what are we going
to
buy you for Christmas? Or?
Finally, someone's asked me. Now, what are you? What's the top of your Christmas list, Andrew?
Oh my God! I'm getting to that point where I have so little space in my house that it has to be something small and something usable. And you become like an old man at a certain point. I actually like getting things like gloves and socks and, you know, things that you wear and you use. I don't need anything unique. I'm just glad that we've all got through this year and we're going to
end up with our friends and family, a smaller group, but we'll have made it through the year.
I think that sounds about right. Faye, you echoing that, or have you got your eyes on something? I know you.
No. Well, I like several things, but a bottle of perfume would be more than enough.
Right,
today,
but not
as well.
One that's been bought online.
Exactly.
Well, listen, with that, that's all there is for today's late edition. A very big thank you to Andrew Tuck and Fernando Augusto Pacheco here in London, to all our editors today, and of course to our studio managers, Steph Chungu and David Stevens. I'm Augusta Macellari here in Studio One at Midori House. Until next time, goodbye and thanks for being with us.